your favorite cartoon characters will help you understand how drugs and alcohol can ruin your life. So watch the program. Talk about it with your family.
Make the right
First off, I want to acknowledge that I'm sorry. I'm sorry for doing this.
Wow, we have a cold open for once. That's going to be good.
Well, I have a question, though. I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Morbius, if you said this was your second time watching it, which implies that you've previously watched it, we're extremely unimpressed, and we're like, yeah, I should talk about this thing that I have no feelings about for an hour.
I watched it twice for the show.
I misunderstood what you said earlier. I was about to say, like, oh, Morbius, it's time to get roasted because you did something illogical, but now I can't say that. So
nope.
Don't apply logic to this.
No. Oh my God! If you applied logic to this, we'd be here all day. But
man, I feel
have we
like,
started? Are we already doing this?
I mean, we're recording. Do the intro. Do the intro.
Oh, okay.
Do it.
Okay. Hi everyone, welcome to special presentation with Mike and Ethan and more. But it's
if you chat enough, you can start pretend. You can pretend like this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is a movie with a lot of scat in it, I'll tell you that much.
It's a lot of scat. What movie are we scatting about today?
This is what is technically a TV special, though I don't think it was originally intended as such, 1987's Rock Odyssey. Until last year, a mostly lost film.
Which is kind of wild because I would swear up and down that I had seen this on VHS rental shelves. Although, I'm pretty sure I had it confused with Street Fight. So I thought that Street Fight had a talking jukebox in it.
The energy in this is extremely Street Fight.
Yes, or this is Coonskin, if you prefer.
Yeah. There's this
the director
like,
did work on Coonskin and a few other Bakshi products.
Yeah,
but you can also see some in the animation. At least I see a little bit of stuff that reminds me of, like, you know, the other Hanna-Barbera things, or Hanna-Barbera / Filmation joints, like Charlotte's Web and Journey Back to Oz.
Yeah, this does there are some stylistic flourishes that are that seem kind of common to Hanna-Barbera products where they were trying, you know, as opposed to their usual slop.
Yes.
You will see
their usual slop though.
Yeah. This feels like something where they thought this is finally going to make us get some respect. No one's going to be pushing around Joseph Han and William Barra anymore. Finally. And we're getting all those fuckers over at Disney with their Fantasia. They're not going to be looking down their noses at us anymore.
Yeah. Someone has to be like, Bill, Joe, you won like 10 Oscars for Tom and Jerry.
I think
Bill Hanna saw the original product here and he just made the Tom screen.
God, a lot of people don't realize that Hanna and Barbera are the creators of Tom and Jerry, but it was before they had their own studio.
Yeah,
you know what? That whole thing about
Siegel Schuster situation.
I feel right. Like all that goddamn all those Tom and Jerry Oscars is like, come on, give it Tom and Jerry. Give him another Oscar. Why not? Give him another Jerry, Tom and Jerry. It's a cat and a mouse. They run in circles. Do they need 20 Oscars for that? Ugh.
The Academy was really impressed by that one part where Tom got his head stuck in a toaster, and then it came out, and it was shaped like a waffle.
I mean, credit where it's due. But this particular movie we're watching tonight is one of the few Hanna-Barbera joints that does not have the regular Hanna-Barbera cast in it, except that it does. but we'll get into that later. So Rock Odyssey, the basic gist is, what if there was an Odyssey, but it was rock related? So it's a phantasmagorical journey through post-war American history set to the tunes that were of the times. So we're going to learn all now, about them. Mm-hmm.
If you were trying to pitch this to me and you said, I want to do Fantasia with rock music, I'd be like, yeah, sign me up. I'm all right for this. And then you throw in, and it's going to have a sort of continuing storyline. Like, oh, okay, I can deal with this. And we're going to re-record all the songs, and it's going to make absolutely no sense. It's like, wait, hang on. Let's go back.
Yeah, this is a, there's a lot of potential in this. The execution is where the problem is.
And this is not, I wouldn't call this the worst thing we've ever done, but it's one of the most disappointing things, because you can really see how they could have done something fantastic with it.
It's one of the most and the least things that's ever been on this show.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is it is one of the movies ever.
It's a movie. It's this is what I think I've described before as more of a vibes film. Feels
usually
kind of
you
like,
say that about something that features robots.
Yeah, well, basically when I say vibes, I mean there's kind of a robot in it. There's our talking jukebox voiced by Scatman Crothers.
Scatman Crothers in his final role. Oh, poor Scatman.
I mean, for starters, it's also similar to Banjo the Woodpile Cat. He's playing an animated character with a very prominent lower lip, which
what that is? I thought it was a mustache.
The top half is a mustache, and then there's this big rubbery thing underneath. And
I'm gonna have to scoot forward and find him again.
Like,
so what you're saying is Hong Kong Fooey is not the most racist character played by Scatman Crothers.
No, it's like, do we need to black code the jukebox?
well, I mean, it's nice to have something black coded in this movie.
It is very America, I guess.
Also, like, you can hear some parts of this where it was, like, I think being re-recorded for continuity issues. Like Scatman was always raspy, but this was, like, deep into his cancer diagnosis, and the poor man was in a very rough place.
I am going to posit that some of this is not Scatman Crothers at all. It's Frank Welker. Because there are
that
parts
actually
where
was
like,
there
yeah,
is.
I was like going to say, some Frank of these parts, Welker. It doesn't sound like him. It doesn't sound like jazz. It sounds like Megatron, which is really weird.
Yeah.
And this was directed by Robert Taylor, who did a bunch of Ralph Bakshi projects. He did Heidi's Song around the same time. Yeah. I don't know if he worked on Hey Good Lookin' or if he had the chance to, but there are parts of the 50s sequence that feel very similar to it, at least in terms of its rambling nature. But
yeah.
Heidi's Song totally tanked at the box office. It like went was up against very stiff competition, and this would have been released earlier, but they, the parent group, the Taft Corporation, yes, that Taft family, was a little bit concerned about the quote-unquote adult theme in it. Like, you know, there's we touch on drug trip and addiction and the horrors of the Vietnam War and
diarrhea.
Briefly diarrhea.
But, yeah.
No, this was like I think they balk a little bit in releasing it, and by the time Heidi's Song came out, they were very reticent. I think Robert Taylor left like a year after later appeared in like Disney TV animation, won a couple of Emmys. But by the time this came out, neither Robert Taylor was at the company, nor was the animation unit, the feature animation unit, responsible for creating this, still around. So they came up with a rather creative workaround for any missing footage, which you can probably already guess what that was.
Reuse footage?
Reuse footage.
And over? And over?
Reuse footage so much that it's 20 years old, some of it.
Yeah, how many times do we see her pass through the bracelet that says Billy?
How many times do we see that one close-up of her gasping face?
Yeah. I mean, okay, this main character of ours, I don't want to hear any more jokes about how they have big eyes in anime, because she defeats them all.
She is dangerously close to a Margaret character.
I was going to say she's dangerously close to E.T.
Well, yeah, the head shape. This is sort of our main narrative character, not the narrator, but our narrative character. I have her in my notes as Lyra. Wikipedia and other sources say it's Laura, but there are no credits, and I don't
know. And the only time we ever see a name for her, she's called Peggy Sue. But the song, Peggy Sue, is not in this.
I interpret it as Lyra because it made more thematic sense, and also because when Scatman Crothers says the name Lyra, it sounds like Laura.
Laura.
Yeah,
so this is her, like, traveling through... I don't know, like, maybe she becomes mortal or whatever, and like rises up from the primeval landscape of rock to romance a different doomed pretty boy every decade.
Yes, and also she has a panther, and sometimes she is the panther, and sometimes she merges with it,
and sometimes she's a cat girl with ears and a tail.
Yeah, look, they said this was a vibes movie. This was a movie that was designed to be watched while high. That's obviously what's going on here with this.
Did you?
No, I didn't. I actually, for once, watched this movie not in the way it was intended to be seen. I was sober. but I could see, like, watching it. I was like, oh, okay, I get what's going on here. But it's... You know, the problem, there are many problems in this film, but one of them is like that. First of all, it's there's four segments because Lyra is, like Morbius said, romancing a different pretty boy every decade. And basically the tone of each decade is kind of the tones and themes are kind of wacky because. You know, the 50s, it's just like, hey, the 50s is cool. You love sock hops. You love diners, right? Yeah.
You love 60s. Carnivals. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then the 60s is just like Vietnam, hippies, drug trips. Wow. It's really, we had that, as Scatman Crothers says, we had that crazy war. Yeah, we did. That's one way to put it.
That's certainly.
And then
what
the
happened.
70s is just like, we're going to go on a boat.
Yeah.
That extreme.
The 70s was extrapolated from a single Save the Whales bumper sticker.
It took me forever to figure out that was what they were doing. I was like, you know, I didn't really think that being a longshoreman was a big deal in the 70s. You know, shouldn't she be like a trucker?
Yeah. Well, trucking was a big deal in the 70s because we had the convoy song, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone was really mad about the gas shortage, I think, OPEC. So we're like, we're going to drive our trucks around. We're doing it again, I guess.
Maybe you can allude to an acid trip on screen, but they couldn't show, like, Lyra blowing rails at Studio 54 with the Goo-Goo Dolls.
No. It is the...
Yeah, when they finally get around to disco, it's the 80s.
Yeah, the 80s section is kind of fascinating because it's like, this was made in the 80s, so we're getting to see how people in the 80s thought of the 80s. And it is not the 80s that we think of in the 2024s.
It was made in the very early 80s. Like, you can see.
Made in the Carter 80s.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't help that every single song from the 80s segment of this is actually from the 70s.
Yeah. Except for the one that they had to sort of plug in at the last minute.
Yeah. They're the.
I don't think. Okay, yeah. It feels like. A very out of touch person's way of interpreting and extrapolating their current decade into something, because musical taste changed so much during just the initial production of this film. Like Scatman Jukebox is like, man, just get back to the basics, good old rock and roll. And he like and plays the song, and it's like, that's the sound of the 80s, and it's like pure 1979.
Well, also, I mean, there's not as much rock in this as I was expecting. A lot of it is, you know, R&B and, you know, adult contemporary,
easy listening MOR stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I would never have considered, you know, Don't Rock the Boat as a rock and roll song, apart from that it actually mentions rocking.
Well, I feel like this special, like you said, it's made by a very, like, how do you do, fellow young people sort of guy, because every decade, the music seems to exemplify that decade less. Because, like, and that may be just because, like, you know, I didn't live through the 50s, so I only have the same, like, fuzzy memories of seeing 50s theme stuff on TV that the people who made this probably had. So it's like, oh, what was the 50s about? You drove to the makeout point, and you had big pompadours, and they were waitresses on roller skates. That's pretty much it, you know? But like when it gets to the 80s, I'm like, well, that doesn't look like the 80s that I remember. But the music, like 50s, is like, it's, you know, they got Blue Suede Shoes, they got The Great Pretender, Blueberry Hill, you know, things that I think of as 50s music. And then the 60s, it's pretty, like, I think the 60s music is also fairly 60s-ish because they have Purple Haze, they have The Age of Aquarius, Blowing in the
Half
Wind.
Half of them are instrumental for some reason.
Well, I guess they couldn't get the rights. I mean, it is ridiculous that they have that Vietnam looms so large in the 60s segment, and they don't have Time of the Season, which, as everyone knows, is the Vietnam song.
Well, they did work in Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth, which is the other Vietnam song.
Yeah, they were trying.
And they don't have Fortunate Son.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, Fogerty was riding them like a bitch on that one. I have to imagine they came up.
Now, you know, like, so the first two segments, I feel like the music it's kind of on point. When you get to the 70s, like, you know, everyone knows 70s music, disco. That's what you think of for the 70s, right? And instead, it's, Bad Bad Leroy Brown, Rock the Boat, Yesterday, I'm a Woman, None of these really scream 70s to me. And
I mean, I'm a woman and I really don't want to know. Those were just popular at the time because they were covered in the 70s by big artists.
Oh, okay. I guess they're trying to ride those coattails.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Robert Jason very clearly doing an Elvis impression in that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, all of them are, doing the closest impression to the original singers they can. When they do Help, they're really trying to imitate the Beatles. Or not just,
strangely, they did not get Jess Harnell for that one, even though he has like
they got him for a lot of them. Yeah. Mm. He's in some of the worst ones.
they got him for Don't Rock the Boat, which he does sound uncannily like Yakko Warner in that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So so the 70s, the 70s, I'm not really feeling it. The 80s is terrible musical choices. Like, partly, like you said, this was made in 1981, so yeah, they didn't really have a lot of choices at that point. Any music that was around would have been kind of still have a lot very 70s tinge. But I think it's insane that in the 80s they have Stayin' Alive, which is the song, literally the song that everyone associates with the 1970s.
Yes,
like, it's like, really? You could not have picked a worse song to try and exemplify the 80s than Stayin' Alive. And then the other song.
Disco sales were up 400% in 1976. If these trends continue, hey.
The other thing about the 80s, though, is when I think of the 80s, there's a lot of dominant musical styles in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We had synth, we had heavy metal, we had hip hop, all these things happening. And it's funny, the 80s are like, you know what we need? All these retro 50s songs. All these songs that, like, when people started, like, let's make the 50s happen again. Because it's like, old time rock and roll, really? That's the most 80s song you could come up with? God.
Still rock and roll to me.
Well, a half of these, it is funny because I remember, I think I've seen clips from this film in another movie in quotes, being Hanna-Barbera's old-time rock and roll hits, where they just made music videos to go along with,
And so it's like DTV?
Just, yeah, exactly. And
they actually did call it HBTV.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. I mean, it's not like Disney had invented DTV in the first place.
Yeah, But I remember because they were like clips in it that I remember thinking like, that does not look like Hanna-Barbera because I do not see Yogi Bear there. And I think I saw some of this in this. Some of the Drug Trip clips were used in that. So at least bits of this, I think, saw light before this was finally, exposed last year. Okay. So I think we should probably go through the different sections. We kind of given people an overview of what whole movie is. Let's talk about the 1950s.
It is by far the most surreal decade somehow.
Yes.
To have lived through or
no, or in this movie. The backgrounds are just fucking bizarre, which is strange because when they talk about rock and roll, this is the rock and roll when you hear Dio singing about rock and roll.
Yeah.
It's still got the pompadours and everything, but it's also got rainbows and diamonds and panthers and goblins and outer space. Yeah, you got the magic!
Also, I want to point out how funny it is that Scatman the Jukebox says, all you needed was a quarter. I was like, a quarter for a song of the jukebox in the 50s?
I wrote down...
Didn't that buy you an album?
I wrote down a quote from this that was just quintessentially meaningless. Everyone was living in a wild world of make-believe that could but only be described as a wop bop a loop bop a lop bamboo.
What the fuck? Oh, no. I heard that and I was like, oh damn, Scatman Crothers, you said a mouthful.
Yeah.
And, indeed, you know, it could only again, be described as wop bop a lap bop ba lap bam boom.
So does anyone what were the black people doing this decade? Were you there?
Just imagine the jukebox like clucking his collar.
Balls he claimed to make in a movie with no Little Richard.
Yeah, for real.
Well, I think in this they're concentrating on a very specific Happy Days style 50s memory.
Yeah, but even Happy Days had Arnold the Chef.
Well, that is the thing about this movie that kind of one of the big disappointing things is like we are talking about like we're going through all American history, right? Or four decades worth. But only one of these decades actually touches on any actual historical happenings. The 60s mentions Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The 70s and 80s don't have anything to do with anything. The 50s is just a parade of various cultural things that like middle-aged white people in the 80s would remember, you know? But it doesn't actually touch on any actual historical events of the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Korean War. There's no, Levittown.
Yeah. Did anyone actually understand the story that was happening in the 50s segment?
I had to write down all of the stuff that happened sequentially because I thought it was the only way I could possibly explain. Okay, so this is the most expensive looking part of the film, I think. Just in terms of like the backgrounds in particular. Like I think this movie was done in sequential order and this part was when they had the most money and creative freedom. Robert Taylor did. Before Joe like looked over his shoulder and said, "What the hell?"
Yeah.
So
we are quartering your budget. What do you think you're doing here, pal? This is Hanna-Barbera. Have them run through an endless hall.
I better be seeing that same lamp go by 30 times.
And when they drive, you better see the bank sign. Bank, 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 bank.
Okay, but the story, we've got like, so Lyra is coming to Earth to get a man, and she goes into an establishment, a 1950s mm-hmm. establishment, and she sees Billy, who is the guy from Hey Good Looking, you know?
Yeah.
And they go through, there are various things involving cars. They have a whole bunch of car crashes. Like they crash the car a lot.
First is like the Great Pretender, which I don't even know what this was about. I theorized it's like maybe Lyra, the immortal being, feeling guilty about like seducing Billy, but that's entirely up to interpretation. And like Billy is sort of chafing against his tough guy image. Again, does not really fit with the rest of it at all. Then
and he seems to literally live in a roller coaster.
He lives underneath a roller coaster and a carnival. And he apparently has like prior history with a gang of black leather goblins who roll up in their Munster coach and beat the shit out of him in an alley.
Oh, that's right. I completely forgot the creepy coup kind of keeps appearing in this segment.
Also, what is going on with this couple that Laura witnesses where there's this guy talking to a girl and then his actual girlfriend comes up and she sort of bobs like she's about to punch him and then instead sort of, you know, slobbers all over his face and then they kiss?
Yeah, it's... I don't know what it is. Like, what?
Did this come from something else?
She's basically the fat squirrel from Sword in the Stone.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like if the fat squirrel had a Madam Mim face. That's basically the girl.
This is about where I realized that this movie missed its calling. It should not have been a TV special or a feature film. It should have been a Laserdisc game like Dragon's Lair.
There you go.
Yeah. But it does bring up like the like Moore mentioned how The Great Pretender doesn't really fit what's happening on screen. And that is a recurring theme throughout this entire film.
Like, almost nothing is syncopated with the actual happenings. The music never really actually connects to what's going on screen, to the point where I sort of thought they had totally different songs in mind for most of the time, and then they just had to take whatever they could get.
And like, yeah, Blueberry Hill is him jump-starting his car by pushing it up a hill of literal blueberries. To a pie diner.
At least there's that. Yeah.
And yeah, but then like it's just about being at the drive-in, and Lyra experiences orgasm at the sight of like James Dean and Marlon Brando and briefly John Wayne, which freaked me out.
Yeah. When I was watching this, this kind of. The whole movie kind of had the feel of a foreign cartoon that they just like, you know, that they obtained and then kind of just had a bunch of people ad-lib the dubs because half the stuff, the music has nothing to do with what's on screen. And the other half of the time, they're just like, oh, well, the music is saying purple haze, have some purple fog, like literal purple fog just come in. And so it's either like way too literal or like completely non sequitur. There's no middle ground.
Yeah. I'm a Woman is definitely the one where they go like, okay, we're just going to illustrate exactly what the lyrics state.
And this is also like, that is like maybe the most pointless of all, because it's like Lyra in a purely powerless state, just like getting drunk. Boat.
Yeah,
that boy, they really wanted to like court like a more adult feel for this movie, you know. Well, anyway, the 1950s, they I think what happens is, does eventually they break up, or no, she breaks up with him, and then he
dies. Okay, I've got to go through this for some reason. He is victimized by like this other monster big rig truck as he's speeding.
Yeah,
it
looks like one of the
day.
Looks like a monster from Jason the Wheeled Warriors.
And his car falls apart, he falls into the ocean, he is swallowed by a giant manta ray, he flies past a pirate ship on the moon. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, he passes by Ghost Planet.
Finally makes it to the prom, and they're like, they're like going steady. She gets his class ring on necklace.
And they do their hair.
Mm-hmm. They do their hair, and their hair tresses like come together and fall in love. Like, so much of this is kind of difficult to parse because it looks like a Nazareth album cover. It's like, I feel like this should be like the most maybe they were trying to go for like, since it was the farthest back in time, it's most primeval and sort of trippy in its backgrounds. But again, the more likely instance is they really did just run out of money, or like Joe cracked the whip.
Yeah.
But anyway, they go up to Makeout Point and
a banana split pulled by 8 motorcycling rats.
Oh, well, yeah. I remember that.
And she slaps him because he got fresh or something there at Makeout Point. I'm sorry. And then very briefly, he tries to rebound with another girl to make her jealous, but she just gives him his class ring and leaves forever. And then
transforming into her original self along the way.
And then he, I don't know, and this fit of primal rock and roll rage, he destroys the prom, which they are back at now for some reason. the punch bowl floods everything. He is attacked by these serpent-like guitars and saxophones, and he's like,
"Yeah,
what the fuck is going on?"
This is why I think that maybe he's, you know, maybe none of this actually happened, and maybe he died in the car accident.
Oh no! And when they dig him up and exhume his body, he's got her scarf from that night.
her earring. Remember?
Mm. Oh, we'll get there. But the thing is that. Not only does this feels like so weirdly out of place because it really feels like Rollover Beethoven should have come before Bye Bye Love, but yeah. Instead it just leaves him back at the same place where he was, like, slumped up against the car, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, so it really feels like much of this movie is out of order.
Like, not only are this going to be a very trippy thing, more of a tone poem, but also that it's not going to take place in a linear fashion, which is really unfortunate if you're like watching this and struggling to make sense of it, which is a good thing, I guess, that the 60s rolls around and it is by far the part with the most plot.
Yeah, ironically, the 60s is the most coherent segment of the entire movie, even though it is explicitly supposed to feel like an acid trip. I actually think the 60s is pretty good, to be honest. It's for what this movie is. Well, I think I like that it's like I like that it's like, okay, there's a plot. I understand what's happening, and it is about the 60s. It feels like the 60s. It feels like the people involved in this at least knew what the 60s was, you know?
You know what that means? It means they weren't there.
well, true enough. But I do like that. I mean, I feel like this actually did kind of capture the vibe of the 60s a little more than the other segments, because the other segments feel like, the 50s feels like someone who heard about the 50s like secondhand. And the 60s, like when stuff happens, like the, you know, the cops show up and they all literally have like siren heads and stuff. It's like, that's pretty good. I like that. It was like,
there's no real social unrest. Like they're protesting the man like turning a park into a parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
They have signs to say, "We like weeds."
It's political.
Like, oh, I see what you're saying.
It's as political as you can get in a cartoon for children, I guess.
Yes.
You don't want to actually like discuss any. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also this is the one where Scatman Crothers just says like, "We had a bunch of crazy times in a crazier war," which is
Scatman. What were the black people doing?
Yeah. The whole plot of this segment is basically there's a new love interest. This time, Bob. He's a hippie. And he dresses like Papa Legba, and
he's basically one of those, he's the Halloween radio voice guy.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, he gets drafted, or he gets the draft notice, so he's really scared, and he thinks everything is a gun, So he's running around from running away from like trees and stuff because he sees guns. And then he does go to Vietnam and presumably is dead. I guess he gets killed in Vietnam. I think that's kind of the implication.
My interpretation of it was that he came back addicted to heroin and like shell shocked.
Is that what the chocolate was?
I do not know how to explain this metaphor.
Yeah, what the fuck is this chocolate scene?
Okay, so for the kids at home, the Lyra and Bob pick up a random, it appears to be a propaganda comic about oral hygiene, you know, and it literally about like, because it's a metaphor is there's a castle and the knight has to get into this castle by defeating a bunch of giant Hershey's Kisses, but he's been infiltrated, so he eats them and he can't like he can't successfully stop them because now he's fat, I think.
And then he turns into one?
Yeah.
That's implied to be literal?
It's a very, you know, it does feel that it feels like they were like, yeah, that's a very children's kind of like Christian morality type thing. Like, oh, don't eat the candy. You'll turn into a giant candy. But yeah, this has nothing. Maybe they thought this was this is probably something that Hanna-Barbera made for, they were contracted to make by like a dentist association. And then it fell through and they're like, well, just stick it in this.
No, the thing is that it's so much weirder than that because the knight, Sir Gleam, has U.S. on his helmet. So it is intended to be a Vietnam War allegory, and I could not parse it at all until, I guess, it ends with him being turned into a candy kiss, and it's like, the moral is, what's good for bad castles? Because the castle Tooth Decay has been eating candy kisses with no problem, seemingly, but they've wreaked havoc on poor Sir Gleam. And it's like, what's good for bad castles is bad for good knights. So I interpreted it as like a right-wing anti-interventionist thing. It's like, leave Asia to communism. We'll defeat them in the global market or something like that. I couldn't fucking tell you.
I mean, the fact that you were able to find any meaning in it is pretty impressive.
I'm really straining.
Yeah.
Also, I should mention that Bob's former life before he became like a full-on piano hippie in San Francisco was he was an accordion busker who annoyed a cat until it died.
that was very traumatic for him. I mean,
then it makes like a visual parallel between him and Jesus Christ.
One thing I give to this movie, we haven't talked about anything else but this movie. This is something that keeps you on target.
Yeah. So
anyway, knock knock, who's there? It's the giant flaming GI skeleton from the trap. And Bob's enlisted to serve. This creates like a already trauma ridden this week, like massive havoc on his psyche, and he starts hallucinating guns and violent and macabre imagery everywhere.
Yes.
He goes
to the tune of there's something happening here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that at least is slightly more on point than when they do the Age of Aquarius.
Which he, I guess, to get peace of mind, he consults two enormous psychics and their Ouija board.
Yeah. What are Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker doing here?
Yeah, I do like that they're like, it's the Age of Aquarius song, and it's like, let's put in a lot of like occult and demonic and like witches sabbat type imagery. And it's like, well, not quite the vibe that the song is going for, you know? Not really what I think of when I think of the Age of Aquarius, but
a little bit more uplifting than that.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
My favorite thing about that song is that before I heard it, years before I heard it, I encountered it as the caption to a Family Circus cartoon where Jeffy was wandering around yelling, "This is the dawning of the age of asparagus." But because I hadn't heard the song, I didn't realize that it was a song, so I thought he was just making strange cryptic pronouncements as he walked around the house.
Oh, that Jeffy.
That bacon hair.
Ugh. Well, you know, this is something the Keens have been dreaming of. Finally, they have a prophet child.
Good old spinweb.
When the dog turns into a gun, it's really cute, actually.
He's adorable. He's like a little breach fire revolutionary pistol.
Yeah, I want to say that I hope that somebody who worked on this also worked on the Brave Little Toaster, because some of these anthropomorphized machines are really cool. I love the design of the jukebox himself, and these anthropomorphic guns and stuff growing out of the park are pretty cool too.
So anyway, Bob either goes fucking crazy or goes to Vietnam, I'm not sure which. And Lyra boards this tiny little electric Kool-Aid bus full of weirdos, where a minister gives her a LSD communion donut. And she trips fucking balls. She's a bag of fries that's getting salted. Bob is a
giant. Oh, I get it. That
ruins their wedding, and it's like they fly up to the moon and he crashes and dies.
I mean, at least look, they're telling you this is an acid trip. So it's like this part not making sense, I think is pretty acceptable. Like, it would be better if it kind of was thematically tied to other stuff, you know, so that it just wasn't random shit. But yeah, you know, beggars can't be choosers.
And then Bob returns from Nam, a drugged out zombie marionette with like a bloodshot 1,000-yard stare. And like, it symbolizes that there will always be. He is lost forever. There will always be some part of him in the jungle, or in this case, the Castle Tooth Decay, which is on fire.
Okay, Mike, what was the thing that I showed you when you were looking for examples of self-published books by crazy psychiatrists who had discovered some insane 12-point plan for the meaning of life? That's what this art style is.
Yeah. No, you are correct. It's that 1970s high on people type look.
Yes. And they could never draw Bob the same way twice. I thought there were like three of him.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's Jesus.
There's a lot of grotesque overacting in the park segment. I guess because it's so normal and easy to follow, you start noticing like how kind of hollow it is beyond the visual.
Yeah.
Well, like, it doesn't have a lot to say besides events happened. I mean, Vietnam happened, but you know, whether it's good or bad, I mean, who can really say?
Yeah.
I talked about this with Mike in regards to Raggedy Ann and Andy, but I feel that there can be a form of overacting in animation, both traditional and digital, which is too much stuff moving for no clear purpose.
Mm.
Like, it's clearly very fun to draw, but at some point you have to, you know, hold the animator's hand and like say, no, okay, that's enough.
Yeah, because at a certain point you're just showing off.
Like, the superfluous movement in the case of Raggedy Ann and Andy can interfere with what a character is trying to convey through body language, because they're just like waddling around and swaying and cantering, and at a certain point they can't take like a single step without every single part of their body just ruffling around. And you think, okay, that could be good for a character like the Greedy, but you can't do it with every single character. And
yeah, I was gonna say, are you vaguing Richard Williams here?
I am vaguing Richard Williams, because a lot of this would feel like a commercial that he would do, but
yeah,
stretched out to feature length. Like, you watch it and you think, oh, should those lesbian cats be talking about kitty litter in quite such an animated fashion?
I really like the lesbian cat kitty litter commercial. I thought that one was pretty charming, actually.
I'm not knocking it, but you see my point. Speaking of vibe, and holistic convergences of the 70s, we get to hear Scatman Crothers say the phrase "immortal crystal life" during this next one.
Immortal crystal what?
Immortal crystal life.
Okay, not immortal crystal light. All right, I was a little puzzled for a second.
Oh, that's right. As we go into the 1970s and the saving the whales, which sort of happens in this. I mean, there is a whale, and I guess they save it. It's about what is it? Lyra meets a new guy. His name is Jack. He has a boat. He has a pet lobster, a wacky pet lobster.
Yeah.
And a wacky seagull who is just kind of there. He doesn't seem completely affiliated.
No, he's a hangers-on. I don't like this lobster, though. This lobster is... I just saw that lobster and was like, oh my god, do we really need a wacky pet lobster with a funny hat? I mean, really? Yeah. Have some dignity, Hanna-Barbera.
The suits were starting to fall asleep at this point. You need something to wake them up. You need a rocket booster. That was a lobster.
This makes me think of, I just recently watched the behind the scenes making of the Bravestar movie, where they were interviewing Lou Scheimer about like making cartoons, and he's just kind of rambling. At one point he says, yeah, you need heroes. And then little animals for the funny. And it's like, yeah, here's a little animal for the funny. So,
yep.
This lobster who I guess is an evil seaman, because he does a lot of stuff on this boat. Yes. And until they find Lyra like encased in ice, I think.
Yeah. How did that happen? Did the trip bus drive her to the bottom of the sea?
She was cryogenically frozen at the end of the 60s and then thawed out at the beginning of the 70s.
So how old is she now? She's gonna be crowding 40.
Yeah, she's 40, but she still holds up well.
Yeah, spoken Lara. Not.
But you know, now she's on this boat with this guy, and they get like stuff happens, I guess. They get menaced by whalers. You know, there's some whalers.
This is just all the whale story. There isn't really anything else exciting happening apart from that, once again, her new boyfriend dies.
Don't know why. They're just pursuing this whale because they have to. It's like, are we going to make oil out of it? Are we going to make perfume? Did he swallow three opera singers?
Yeah, in the 70s, what were we whaling for, I guess, is the question. Like, it's like, what do we need? Oh, we need that ambergris. I don't know. I'm not sure when we decided whaling was bad. You know, when I guess I should look that up. But
I know that anyway, Japanese high schools, they still have one specific day when the cafeteria serves whale. Like one day per year.
I remember reading like a compilation of essays from Japanese children or students, I guess high school students, about whaling. And yeah, I guess it was one of those assignments where they have to argue for or against it. And I just remember like every single kid was basically like, I think whaling is bad because they are intelligent creatures and they're endangered and we need to protect the earth. But I don't think we should make it illegal until after I have tasted whale because I really want to eat a whale. So points for being honest, you know?
Yep.
In conclusion, cetaceans are a land of contrasts.
I mean, I have eaten whale, so I can tell you it's okay. It's all right.
I'm imagining it being really chewy.
It's like if beef was sweet is kind of how I would describe it.
What the spaghetti at Jollibee is made from?
It does actually taste a lot like spaghetti, Jollibee spaghetti. I will say that. So
yeah, but you could just like I could also put like banana ketchup on beef and get much the same effect.
Yeah, that's basically it. There's really, you know, so what I'm saying is there's really not much reason to whale, at least in my opinion, in my esteemed opinion, as, you know, as an expert in the taste of whale. You know what they should be hunting? Ptarmigan. Those bastards are tasty.
I went to Iceland too. I don't care if it's soft and sweet. Knock it off. I don't care if it's buttery. But anyway, he narrowly gets Ahabbed, by which I mean like dragged under by the tow rope. But like the whale deposits him in the dinghy, and they're all floating there. And poor Jack is fading fast. And Lyra flashes back to when she was a child. And she witnessed another little boy who she sailed with in a washtub fall off an elephant's trunk and die.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is done in a very Little Golden Book style, this sequence.
Yeah. And the animation is, you know, as low as, you know, it's this side of Reading Rainbow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think because they briefly showed this stuff in the opening credits, the same like little two kids. So I assume the kid who drowned is supposed to be, she's looking for him reincarnated in these various dudes that she gets with every 10 years.
The little boy never shows up again. And this like immortal personification of music apparently once had a childhood. Like, yeah, not only does 40s. It not make sense, but it makes so much less sense that everything else makes a little less sense along with it. It drags it down to its level.
I don't like this scene where it looks like the lobster is trying to get too cozy with her and be like, baby, say, so you're single?
Yeah.
Luckily, the lobster doesn't hang around much. He dies
and disappears. And then the fucking beast from the sea from Revelation rises from the ocean. I'm not fucking kidding. Yeah,
heralded by a bunch of Muppety monsters ahead of time.
And then Seals and Croft plays, and Jack, like, the ancient city of Relay, like, rises from the wave, and Jack comes out and, like a psychopomp, takes his lobster friend to be with him beneath the waves. And Lyra is left alone with the fucking bird.
Yeah. Because she can't catch it.
So does that imply, so this lobster dies. The lobster is now dead as well.
I guess they were like, oh man, no water, no food except for this melted butter. Now what do we do?
Well, and then we learn that Lyra is a woman.
That's right. Well, you know, feminism was invented in the 1970s, so you know, it scans. That's when them broads, you know, got all uppity. So yeah,
and we celebrate feminism by having her half nude in a series of pinup outfits.
Well, and also be extremely drunk. Bottle.
Yes. From an empty bottle.
Yeah. But yeah, this is great because the whole 70s is just like wailing, wailing. And then suddenly it's like, oh, I'll put in this thing about feminism, I guess. I guess it's feminist, you know.
Writing on a spatula.
They're kind of, it's commenting on feminism the same way the 60 segment is commenting on Vietnam or police brutality or any of the other issues that it kind of broadly hints at, but never does anything with. It's just, this was a thing, you know.
This is where I noticed that, wait a minute, didn't she used to have magic powers that she used to rescue Billy a bunch of times?
Yeah, but she's a lot older now, so, you know.
Well, maybe that's what I'm a Woman is about. She's rejecting her goddesshood.
Oh.
Which is odd, because you think it would be about reclaiming her goddesshood, but...
She's giving it all up to be a mere mortal, just like in that other movie we know and love, Tarzan.
Mannequin.
Yeah. I couldn't think of a movie. Mannequin, yes, Mannequin 2, On the Move.
Yeah.
This is basically the same plot.
The Lobster is a clear stand-in for Hollywood.
Yeah.
God, well, she could, and she will. But then she resigns herself to the go-go 80s, by which I mean the late 70s.
She rescues herself at some point.
She rescues herself at some point. The next we see of her is just like, it's just like something that was clearly filmed after the fact, where it's like just like Reagan and Ayatollah like scrawled on this graffiti background, and like Frank Scatman is like, well, we don't know enough about this decade yet. Boring data entry job.
I guess they're acknowledging computers now.
Yeah. She's getting unwanted attention from a manlet and then gets rescued by a handsome mustache man that is like so 1970s hurt.
Magnum Duck!
I do like this sequence just because it gives us a window into, you know, what people of the time expected the decade to be, and it is that very, like, you know, it's that very early 80s where everyone's wearing three-piece suits, everyone feels like extras from like 9 to 5. It's about a woman going out, you know, doing stuff on her own, you know, it's basically, you know, Lyra is now Kathy. She's a woman in the workplace and dealing with all the trials and tribulations that entails. But since it's from 1981, it doesn't really do much with any of this. Then it's like, okay, what if also Lyra, as a go-go modern 80s woman in the workforce, you know, in her 1980s giant secretary glasses, very stylish, what if she had to fight the Goblin King? It's like, okay, extremely 80s. I mean, actually, that is kind of 80s, but it's not the Goblin King you would think. Not the Goblin King, 80s Goblin King we all know and love. This is like
in a maze of some kind.
That's true. I do like the continued implication that the goblin, this disgusting green goblin thing is the latest iteration of all the hot dudes she's been, you know, jonesing for the last 30 years. And it's like, okay, is that his true form? Is that what you're saying? She's going to fuck a goblin? More power.
I mean, if it's a guy that you've known since the 50s, he's probably going to be a little egg-shaped by the 80s. You know? It happens.
It's true. It's true. I just think it's funny that he's all that. It's like, yeah, here I am. This is my true form. Now you can appreciate that I am Goblin. And it's like, I guess that's nice. It's nice. It shows there's hope for the rest of us, you know. But
so, do you think this manlet is Bob Parr's boss when he was young?
I kind of, is the mustache man, does she get with him? Is that another iteration of the goblin, or is that just some guy? I kind of forgot.
That is another, let's try to get through it in order, because there's a lot of establish here.
Yes.
So Lyra bangs her head on a computer, and we ran out of money. So we get a little eep, op, orc, ah-ah footage. We get some, hey there, it's Yogi Bear footage. We get some man called Flintstone footage. It basically,
we get some,
like,
what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this footage?
Mm-hmm. Like, anything
we never
we could...
get to see Fred and Barney dressed as the two-headed caterpillar, disappointingly.
Like, just anything from other musical numbers that we could scrape off the cutting room floor and piece together. And set to
Wake
me
you
up
before me go-go.
Yeah, that at least is that's kind of, I guess that's kind of an iconic 80s song. So at least it's from the 80s, unlike, you know.
Yeah. Not something from the 80s that everyone has completely forgotten, like, oh, I don't know, I Can't Wait by New Shoes.
Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go is the most 80s thing about this. But again, because it's like, oh yeah, on the road again, classic 80s song. Just the Way You Are, classic 80s
song.
I didn't realize that
On the Road Again was from the 80s or even the late 70s. I thought it was from the 60s, so. But no, it's from like this movie from like the real early 80s.
It is, yeah. I mean, technically it is 1980, so it just made it into the 80s.
Rocket Prime Jive, that song that they keep playing over and over again. That's a Bad Queen cover of Bad Queen song from 1978.
Is that the one that plays over the credits?
Yeah.
I kind of like these scenes where Fred Flintstone is dancing with Quartz in San Diego or whatever you would call her.
At least it's something. It's very, well, I guess they were like, it's the 80s. It's time for Klauser Hanna-Barbera characters.
Time
for
Chattanooga Cats. Does anyone even remember them?
I didn't realize they were an actual thing in the 80s. I thought they just made them up for, like, you know, what a cartoon when they were getting all retro in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's one thing about this movie. It is so obscure that they didn't even mention it on OKKO. OKKO went as far as including the fucking Moxie show.
Well, I...
And then she, like, goes on the road again, like, traveling cross-country to, like, all the places he used to be, I guess. She's reminded of Jack, then she's reminded of Bob when she sees a moving man playing a piano. But then it revealed, like, a horror moment that his hand is black, and she's disappointed.
Like, no thanks!
Got a big old laugh out of me accidentally. And finally she makes her way to the dilapidated jukebox joint where she first met Billy. And somehow this abandoned building is still getting electricity because she flips it in, and she begins grooving to the Terrible Queen song. And then she realizes that the Billy with graying temples are one concession to the passage of time is standing there. And all of these men, they were all single true form of this immortal being, which she never encountered before, apparently, but they're perfect for each other. And it ends, and not even Scatman's really sure how to wrap this one up.
Yeah.
is the implication that this immortal being that she gets with is the same kid from the bucket in the beginning who she watched drowned?
Oh, we can't even think about that.
No.
We didn't think about how that fitted into everything else. We can't unwrap that because definitely no one else thought about it. It was just a cool juxtapositional set of images that bear no larger meaning to the story at large, much like this film's relationship to the 20th century.
Okay. Well, let's continue it. Who would she meet in the 90s?
Oh, that's obvious. She'd meet a grunge guy.
Okay. What would happen in the 90s? He would get brainwashed by video games and shoot up a school.
That was a big thing in the 90s.
He's doing something with a gun. Maybe he's learning to work it with his toes.
That was a big thing in the 90s. Well, you know, she could see, they could probably, like, you know, drink some, what is that, that clear Coke and watch the Berlin Wall fall. You know, those were things you did in the 90s. Oh, no! You know what would happen? If they did the 90s segment, Bill Clinton would come on and play a saxophone.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. We got Billy, Bob, Jack, and now Bill.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Right, the 90s. Maybe it's the end of history. It's nothing but Surge and Smash Mouth from now on.
People in the 90s could not get enough of Bill Clinton playing that saxophone. Man, oh, yeah. We just were like, that is the coolest thing I've ever, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen, man. It's like, you know what it was like? In the 80s, if you saw a dog wearing sunglasses, like, you'd be like, wow! In the 90s, that was Bill Clinton playing the saxophone. You'd be like, it was just incredible. You'd be like, yeah, what a time to be alive. That's what they tried to take away from us. There's nothing cool like that now. Like, what's cool nowadays? Nothing. No one. Everything sucks. We don't have it.
Anytime someone tries to show you something cool anymore, it's just some shit they made in Minecraft.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah. Real. I made a thing in Minecraft. Yeah. Good job, child. I hate you because you're young. Stupid children. Oh, they're the worst.
No, I'm 30. That's why I had time to make this giant homage to the Beetlejuice cartoon the last 10 minutes.
Shut up. The Beetlejuice cartoon is good, actually.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, I'm citing an actual thing I saw someone make in Minecraft.
Oh, all right. Well, you know, I was watching the Beetlejuice cartoon just the other day, and I was like, you know what? It turns out this cartoon is actually really good. It really makes you think, because, like, there's like layers in Beetlejuice. You ever think about that? Anyway,
you know what really reminded me of Beetlejuice was the scene where during Blue Suede Shoes, where the two of them actually turned into shoes and danced together.
Oh, that's an extremely Beetlejuice thing to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Because they do that, but then Beetlejuice would be like, what? I got soul. What's wrong? Cat got your tongue? Wah! You know, and he would do all that stuff because he loves.
I love your Chantilly laces.
Yeah, he loves. See, Beetlejuice loves making jokes that reference the thing he is, you know? So if he turns into a thing, he's going to make a joke about that thing. Anyway.
It's clever in time. See, I'm a thing.
It's kind of his curse. I believe Beetlejuice has been cursed.
Actually, there is an episode where his enemies take advantage of that and use it to try to destroy him.
My God. You know, see, that's his weakness. Because he's a trickster figure, so you can only use his powers against him. You can't defeat him otherwise.
See, Beetlejuice was really on a different level because it was incorporating metafiction in its wordplay running gag.
Yes.
You know, see, they don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe they sure do, actually. I don't know.
This movie.
They do. There's not a whole lot of wordplay in this movie.
I mean, I didn't even get the joke about how she was fries and now she was being assaulted, but...
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, everyone's living in a magical world of way make-believe that you can only describe as bap-bap-a-loo-bop-a-lop-wham-boom.
Okay, I like the scene in the very beginning where after the jukebox introduces us, we're getting this slow pan into like the planet Mars or something. And, you know, I don't know about you, but my first thought was, I don't want to die alone on the moon.
Oh, well, you know, it's very appropriate because Martians were big in the 50s, but so was Gumby, you know?
Yeah. And actually, yeah, the jukebox even turns into a UFO during that scene.
Man, see, that would have that. See, that's that they concentrated on, like, oh, remember in the 50s when like there were all those Martians that came down? That would be a good 50s segment, actually. They should have done that.
Yeah.
But you know, stupid boomers wanted their like their diners, I guess.
Yeah. And what were adults doing in the 50s? Well, dying in the mud in North Korea, but
yeah.
And anyway, we close with the most wretched version of old time rock and roll.
Oh, okay. Is that the worst song? Morb and I were discussing this earlier. Which is the worst cover for you, Mike?
I will say that like the music immediately sloughed off my brain once this movie ended because there was no there was no connection between any song and what was going on at any point in this movie. It was just kind of like random music from the decades. Here you go. And pictures are moving on the screen. You know how Disney syncopated their music to their visuals? Not here. That's not how we do it. Hanna-Barbera land. Just here you go. Eat it up. Slop for you, togs. The only music I actually remember is The Age of Aquarius. So I'm going to say that's the worst. Or maybe it's the best because I remember it.
The best cover for me is probably I'm a Woman, because it handles like the sultry vocals and the over-the-top big brass band style actually like fit it very well. Like, it's a strutting song.
Yeah.
It's very kittenish. You have to kind of go into a little bit of an Anne Margaret fugue state when you perform it. And
there's only one thing to do in a situation like this. Strut!
I named probably as one of my very worst, just in terms of like how far it was from the original, probably Stayin' Alive, because you can really hear the session musician guys like struggling to hit those high notes. Like,
yeah, it's yeah, falsetto
came naturally for the Gibb brothers, and it does not for the
yeah.
The one that stuck with me was Great Balls of Fire, because they took the instead of you know, there's a part in Great Balls of Fire where Jerry Lee Lewis says, "Kiss me, baby, ooh, ooh, feels good," but they interpreted the ooh-hoo part as a big smoochy sound, like ooh-hoo. I was like, ah, disgusting.
And that's your sole objection?
Well, no, the rest of it is terrible too, but that part I had to skip through. And this was what? Okay. Now that we've done it, what inspired you to want to do this on our show?
The mere fact that it was a TV special, it aired at least once, just therefore making it eligible. But also, I kind of wanted to see it as a perverse experiment in how far we could stretch, like, you know, like how stretching a handful of songs and a bunch of very fluid animation out to 72 minutes made this? I wanted to see if we could talk about this for longer than the movie itself. And we did.
Did we make it?
We made it.
We made it! Oh my god. It's a miracle. Or, no, it's not. We always talk about the movie for longer than the actual movie. But But
well, if you want to find this, we watched the amalgamated version, which, as of this recording, is on Internet Archive. It was cobbled together from a Latin American broadcast and something on Boomerang just to get like extra footage. Mm. So, if you,
it still might not be the whole thing then.
No, this is complete and full, mm. or at least in its broadcast was. Hmm. So, if you want to check it out, please be informed that it might not be available by the time you go look. But also, I feel like you should only check it out if you are absolutely, completely, 100% can't live without it, curious. Because otherwise, I fear that you might walk away to.
It's a difficult watch, not least because the download was 3 gigs, and it took me forever to watch the whole thing. I was watching it like a couple seconds at a time because I was having internet problems.
Well,
and you know, and every time I managed to hit play, I was like, that wasn't worth hitting play again for.
Well, I kind of liked it. Not gonna lie. It wasn't good, but it was fascinating. As you know, I'm like a big fan of like heavy metal and you know, movies of that ilk.
Oh, speaking of which, the jukebox said that it was going to be a rock and roll heavy metal story, but there was no heavy metal in this movie.
No, this was very much geared like to things that, well, you know, this was a movie that was, well, think about this. It's obviously not for kids. It's for adults. It's for the middle-aged boomers who, you know, made up the bulk of adults in the 80s. And this is what they would think rock and roll is, you know? Oh yeah, it's nice. It's nice music. Oh, I don't want any of that heavy metal. We don't want any of that rap music. We don't want any of that. We want music got a fat beat you can bug out to. And here you go. It's a lot of, there's a lot of doo-wop and a lot of R&B and maybe a single disco anthem in this. But yeah, I mean, I really like the concept that they had. I really appreciate that they tried, you know, they did try to do something here. Mm-hmm. I wish it was way better. I wish it had it encapsulated something more real about rock and roll or about America. It didn't really have either. It was more just like, yeah, let's just fill some time, you know, which is a real disappointment. But like, I'm, you know, I think the 60s sequence, even though it didn't have anything to say, it did so much with, it was, you know what it's like. Okay. It's like, I think when the comics curmudgeon talks about like, joke-like material, you know, like, because like watching the 60s section, it's like there's no actual commentary here, but it is filled with commentary-like material. It feels like it should be saying something because they have the visual language down. They know what things should be. When you see cops come in with the siren heads and you see this stuff, you're like, okay, I get it. It's like, you know, it's like watching The Wall, except if The Wall had nothing to say. And it was just like
a Jason allegory.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
It's like it's like doing a belly flop into a ball pit full of political cartoon iconography.
Yes. It's like, you know, if you watch this and then like, you know, a big, you know, a pig wearing an Uncle Sam hat with like a government cheese written across his chest walks around and a crying Statue of Liberty, you know, it's like, I know what those mean. I don't know what they're doing here, but you know what it is? It's like reading a fucking Sinfest cartoon is what it is. It's like, Yeah. I see all the iconography. I know these mean things, but like, you're not putting them together in a way that actually means something. You're just kind of throwing them out there And then because we have pattern seeking brains, your average person will watch this and see, ah, I see drugs, I see hippies, I see Vietnam. Clearly this means something. And it's actually, you know, it's deep. Man, it makes you think, when in fact it does none of those things. It's just because we fill in the gaps ourselves.
How embarrassing for both this and for Sinfest that Burke Breathed can make more salient political points.
Burke Breathed, yeah, like, again, is kind of in that same wheelhouse where he has commentary-like material in his work. Because as a child, you read it and you're like, oh, this is very, like, you know, astute political commentary. And then you're an adult, you're like, no, he just thought the name Casper Weinberger was funny. But he does
expect it to Lee Iacocca again.
But Burke Breathed does occasionally, you know, make points. I mean, he's not, like, completely frivolous. He, you know, you can read his stuff and be like, he clearly has a viewpoint and he has things to say, you know. But, this movie, if on a scale between Burke Breathed and Tetsuya Ishida, yeah, it's more towards the Tetsuya Ishida line, I think.
It's one of those unfortunate issues when you're a creator, in which is sort of akin to the over-expressive animation, I think, is that if you are too wrapped up in something, you have reconciled an understanding during its creation. You need to think about the person who has never interacted with any of these concepts, who is coming to it fresh, needs to think. Because I understood this movie much more on my second watch through than my first. Because I was at least familiar enough with what happened in it to be paying attention rather than just sitting in mute horror. But like that's an issue of creators can sometimes just get a little too high up their ass.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the best thing you can say about this is maybe they it feels like they wanted to make something, but their vision exceeded their grasp.
And Hanna-Barbera never took a chance on anything again.
No.
Well, what was the next movie they made? When did Chomps come out?
Was Chomps theirs?
Yeah, Chomps was Hanna-Barbera.
I don't know if I would call it a bold experiment in storytelling.
It had swearing in it. That's how you knew it was for adults.
I guess the next thing they did after this was Jetsons the movie.
Not a lot of boundaries being tested in Jetsons the movie.
No. I mean, the fact that they acknowledged that the whole idea being that it was that they live in space needles to rise above the pollution. I mean, you could build a whole movie just around that, but it's just like the first thing you see and then they go on to something else.
Yeah, it is. It's an environmental movie, if I recall correctly. It was about how it's good to save the environment because there's cute animals.
Not the first time they've made that thing anywhere. There's also Yogi's Ark Lark, where they're looking for the perfect place.
Oh, is that what that series was about?
Yeah, Yogi's Gang. Or Yogi's
I remember the arc. I thought they were just solving mysteries or something.
No. They were searching for somewhere that wasn't polluted. It was all in the theme song.
Oh, I guess I didn't pay a lot of attention because that was a Sunday morning show.
Oh, yuck.
But Hanna-Barbera did take one chance with Jetsons the movie, and that is casting Tiffany as Judy Jetson.
Yeah.
Instead of like a 100-year-old, I don't know, they got the 100-year-old Elroy voice, but
yeah,
you know, because everyone else in that movie last, is.
It was Mel Blanc's last role. And,
fuck you, Janet Waldo, apparently.
Well, Tiffany was very big at the time.
Yeah. Yes, not at any other time.
Yes, much like Rock Odyssey, she too was damned to remain a prisoner of the 80s.
Yep. Well, and you know what we need to do? We need to bolt some Hanna-Barbera footage onto her. Then people will watch it.
Well, so Rock Odyssey. Sounds like this one is a big nope from y'all.
I don't know, because I am looking forward to subjecting other people to it.
Like I said, only 100% curious, but seeing is believing. Believe me, I've seen.
Yeah, I've seen worse. This is... Yeah.
I gotta say, this feels less like something for us and more like something for Have You Seen This?
Oh, well, yeah, I should tell I'm going to tell him to watch this. I'm going to tell him, like, hey, yeah, you know, you should check out Rock Odyssey. If you really want to rock and roll, you really want to keep on rocking, you got to rock out with Rock Odyssey. It's about the Odyssey of rock. Look, it's about a time when everyone lived in a magical fantasy world that can only be described as bop 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 loo bop lop bam boom. Bop wop lop lop bop bam boom. Bop a lop a wop gop bop. I'm not sure how you say that actually now that I think about it.
You put a wallet under your tongue?
It goes like bop a bop bop a lop bebop a lop.
Wop,
wop,
wop, bop, a loo, bop, a lop, bam, boom. My God, man.
Wop, bop, a loo, wop, bop, a. My God. Okay.
Jammer Gumby.